Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. How about applying free market principles and some basic common sense to the very convoluted, complicated world of healthcare? Principles like competition and truth in pricing. Can it be done? A lot of people have given up. It seems like such a complex issue. But one man can make it all very clear, and he's a practicing physician to boot. Here is Dr. David Graetzer. Dr. Graetzer, I want to go back to something you wrote 12 years ago. This is quite remarkable. You were only 24 years old. You published your first book, and you were still in medical school. And here's what you wrote. The magicians believe that with just the right combination of government regulation, Medicare will magically work. The spendthrifts argue that more government spending would solve every problem, from the attitude of the grumpiest hospital orderly to the lengthiest waiting list for radiation therapy. On the surface, they seem to have little in common. Both magicians and spendthrifts, however, believe in a government-run healthcare system, and while they don't agree on the best way to reform Medicare, they basically believe that government action will provide the solution. And obviously, you didn't agree then, and you don't agree now, but what strikes me is, why did you have that intuition so early? Most people get fed up with the system as they slog through it over the years. You weren't even in it yet.
Well, that's not totally true. I mean, I was born and raised in Canada, and when a relative got sick, they entered into the system. Though I was relatively healthy, I obviously had my own contact in that, you know, suggested my own experiences. So you're right. I mean, I hadn't practiced for 20 years when I wrote that, but I'll stand by it because it's accurate. And it's accurate in terms of the debate that we've had over these last dozen years. And unfortunately, we've implemented both ideas, and I think they're a bad set of ideas. We spend more than we've ever spent on healthcare. We've more administrators than we've ever had, more bureaucratic rules as well. And yet the system still falls short, because I don't think it's about hiring more magicians or spending more money, as spendthrifts would have us do. It's about some fundamental flaws you have in a public system.
And how did it get so bad? Because after all, when you look at our other systems, our other basic systems in society in North America, the financial system, God knows, has had its share of troubles in the past few years. The legal system is far from perfect, but willy-nilly they muddle through and we get things done. This one just gets heavier and more bureaucratic, and yet it deals with health, something that is so important to all of us. How did it get so inefficient and so bad?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I think there are tremendous successes in the system, and one shouldn't forget that. I mean, if you are sick today, I think you get far better care than you would have gotten 60 or 70 years ago, and that's true in Canada, it's true in the United States, it's true right across the Western world, because medicine has gotten so much better. I mean, when we talk about health policies we're doing today, I think it's important to remember how much has changed, not in the last 600 years, but really in the last 60 years. You have the clinical use of penicillin, and then you have a series of amazing changes that literally revolutionize the way we live and the way we die, okay? And that high-tech, high-expense medical revolution, which started really, I guess, in 1941 with the first clinical use of penicillin, continues on to this day. So when you say what's going on with the healthcare system, why do problems persist? It's because medicine continues to evolve, and yet in so many ways our health policy doesn't. I mean, we have, both in Canada and the United States, healthcare systems that really rise out of the philosophy of the 1940s.
And one thing I'm hearing increasingly, for either from doctors, patients, just about everybody really, is how come a veterinarian's office or a dentist's office works better than a doctor's office? With those guys, you make an appointment, you show up, you get a treatment, you pay, you leave. And it's simple, but it's crazy that that should be the model in a way, and yet it is. But why can't we go back to that in the realm of medicine?
Well, medicine has grown very complicated, and we've done some things with health policy that are problematic. And these are things we've done right across the Western world, whether you're talking about Canada and a single-payer system, or you're talking about the United States, which has both a public system and a private system. And what we've done there is we've really separated out the individual from health expenses. Okay? In the United States, there's a perception that people pay for the healthcare they receive, but they don't do it directly. For every dollar spent in healthcare, actually only 12 cents comes from the individual's pocket. In Canada, even less. And as a result, what do you have in healthcare, as opposed to veterinary medicine, as opposed to law, as opposed to 20 other examples you could come up, food, clothing, shelter, by the way, all basic needs. What you have in healthcare here is virtual buyer's market, where we've got a lot of money on the table, and we're not really paying for result, because the people who are paying are removed from the decisions.
So then what will it take? Will it take the very determined political will of a Ronald Reagan or a Chris Christie, or in Canadian terms, a Mike Harris or a Ralph Klein, political will expressed by a powerful leader who comes in and breaks the will of these people? Is that what we need?
Well, I'm not going to make political predictions because I have enough trouble practicing medicine, never mind predicting the future. But I'm reminded of the wisdom of Harry Stein, who, as you recall, was a very prominent economist in the 1970s. Harry Stein actually was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors at one point in time. He had a wonderful sense of humor. Harry Stein observed that that which cannot go on forever will eventually stop. Stein's point is that some systems don't work, and over time it just becomes clear because the basic economics won't work. What you're seeing in Canada is that we pay more and more for healthcare, and you're not getting value for money. What we see in the United States is health inflation that's 7, 8, 9% a year. We know that these systems aren't sustainable over time, not with the aging of the baby boomers, not with the continuing effects of the high-tech, high-expense medical revolution. So what's going to give in these systems, what's going to cause fundamental change? Basic arithmetic, I suspect.
And speaking of basic arithmetic, as you pointed out just a few minutes ago, modern medicine has so many innovations, can do so many wonderful things, that naturally every patient and their family, their loved ones, would want the very best for each one and for each condition, including expensive surgery and so on. But is that within our reach? Are we dreaming too big, or is it feasible?
I suspect it is feasible. I suspect it is feasible in the following way. If you look at what happens in a free market system, if you're talking about food or clothing, what you find is that over time, value increases and prices fall, right? I mean, let me give you a very simple example. When I was a kid, and we'd call my grandmother in Europe, long-distance phone calls were so expensive that we'd queue because we didn't want any time between, because it was just so expensive for my parents to call my grandmother. Today, long-distance prices are a pittance, and of course, if you use something like Skype, I mean, you don't even pay at this point in time. I mean, that's one example. Let me ask you a quick question. Do you have a computer?
Sure.
Sure. Did you have a computer on your desk 15 years ago?
No.
Okay, but if you did, I'm willing to bet that it would have been clunky, expensive, and not very good. And today the equivalent model is a fraction of the price. That's what happens when you have competition and you have people shopping around. And over time, whether you're talking about something like computers or you're talking something like a basic need like food, prices actually fall over time. It's one of the most remarkable things. Healthcare is different. Whether we're talking about what's going on in the United States or what we're talking about in Canada, in healthcare, prices rise year after year after year. No matter what. I mean, look at healthcare in the United States. I mean, health prices have risen roughly, if one looks at health inflation, what, 7-8% over the last decade? I mean, we've had almost a doubling in costs over a decade if you look at raw prices or you look at, say, health insurance costs. And yet, would anyone say that healthcare is twice as good as it was 10 years ago? Of course not. It's because basic things that work in other sectors of the economy, in the 5/6 of the economy that isn't dominated by government, it works completely differently. So what you need to do with healthcare, well, whether you're talking about the American system or you're talking about the Canadian system, you need to look at the rest of the economy for ideas and look at implementing those ideas within healthcare.
And so is it hocus pocus when the establishment says, well, CAT scans, open heart surgery, those things are hugely expensive and always will be and will always be out of reach? Can those things be, through productivity, commoditized like a computer? Is that what you're saying?
Well, to some extent, yes. To some extent, no. Okay. I mean, there are certain things about healthcare that are always going to make it very different. Okay, but I mean, MRIs and CAT scans would be great examples of things that should collapse in terms of price over time. Okay, why not? Well, part of it is unionization. Part of it is we just treat healthcare differently than any other sector of the economy. Okay, people don't shop around, right?
Well, they can't.
It's very difficult to. In Canada, I mean, we would have no idea what prices are like. In the United States, we don't ask about prices. I've got a friend, he's a bit of a troublemaker, and he lives in Vermont, and his doctor asked him to get a basic blood test. And so he decided to write to a few clinics, as well as the local hospital, and ask what was the price of a basic blood test. Okay, and the hospital got a little bit worried, and they sent their public relations person to write him a letter back asking why he was inquiring about prices. I mean, that example is so absurd, and yet, if you ask me how much a quarter milk costs, there's no difficulty getting an answer. And until we move decisions closer to individuals and families, until we have price transparency, until we have competition, I think you're going to see price rise year after year in healthcare without necessarily getting any value for money.
And when will we reach that point of absurdity in the system where, as you describe it, there's no truth in pricing, there's no truth in costing, and everything just bloats out of control? When will we reach that tipping point?
Well, I think particularly in the United States, you're probably closer to a tipping point than people assume. I mean, let's talk about just one statistic that's much quoted in this past presidential campaign, income of the average American family has actually dropped over the last decade. Okay, or to go back to Reagan's question, American families are actually worse off than they were a decade before, at least in terms of income. The largest reason for that, and there are a few reasons for that, but the largest reason for that is not because gas costs so much. Okay, it's not because maybe there's been a bump in the ride in terms of food costs. The larger reason for that is that health insurance costs keep rising feverishly. Okay, and you see similar things in Canada. We're doing this interview today in Toronto, Ontario, and as you know, in the provincial government of Ontario, roughly 46 cents of every dollar spent by the government is spent on healthcare. Okay, not roads, not education.
Outside right? The debt, yeah.
Right? Excluding, of course, debt servicing. You're right. So we're seeing more and more dollars allocated to healthcare, and I think at some point in time we reach a tipping point where people say, you know, we expect better quality, okay, and we also want more options. And as a result, I think we're not far for the sorts of changes that I think would be reasonable. Okay.
And might we see one day some kind of grassroots revolt, some kind of groundswell among doctors? After all, they take the Hippocratic Oath, they believe in what they're doing, then they set out on the road into this system, and they might end up defending it as a group for their own interest, but deep down they don't agree, and you wonder, you know, someone like you, you're certainly not the only one who's rebelled against this.
Well, look, there's no one opinion of a doctor, or doctors rather. I mean, there are tens of thousands of doctors in Canada and many more in the United States. But I think one finds a frustration amongst people who practice in the system, whether they're doctors or they're nurses or social workers. And I think you'll see more and more people say, well, we spend more money. And the system, whether you're talking about north or south of 49th parallel, seems to be more bureaucratized than ever. Is there an alternative?
In a way, I'm wondering which key will turn in the lock to finally unlock a real system that works. Is it the doctors? Is it the taxpayers? Is it the politicians?
Yes. It's all of the above. I mean, I think just general dissatisfaction with the status quo will catch up to the system.
You've also written rather amusingly about the McVictim view of obesity in America, that somehow large corporations are stuffing us with burgers and supersized soft drinks and so on. You have no truck with that.
Well, I think obesity is a major issue. And I don't think there's any doubt that people are less healthy than they were 10 years ago. If you look at some basic statistics around obesity, diabetes, which is obviously connected and so on. But I think we have to be very careful about very simple solutions to these sorts of problems. And in the United States today, there is a school of thought arguing that we're all McVictims, that we're being exploited by corporate America, who are duping us into larger and larger portions, much against our will, without our knowledge, etc. And I just think that's silly.
What do you think then when Mayor Bloomberg wants to downsize soft drinks?
Not much. Look,
but you're saying the individual has enough info and enough willpower and should be able to take care of it himself.
Well, I mean, look at some of Bloomberg's efforts. I mean, one of the biggest initiatives he put forward is calorie labeling. Okay, look, I'll be perfectly blunt. This doesn't keep me up late at night. Okay, I don't think the Republic is going to collapse because when you walk into a McDonald's in New York, you can see the calorie count on a Big Mac. But there have been seven major studies published in this field, and no study really has shown any impact, which is kind of what you would expect. In fact, one of the seven major studies suggested that people actually order more calorie-rich foods when they go to a fast food restaurant when they can see the calorie postings. Or
really?
to put it in more basic terms, most people who went to McDonald's weren't expecting a healthful meal in the first place. I think obesity is one of those great issues that we struggle with as a society, but that the people who are involved in making decisions, the public health officials who advise government officials like Mayor Bloomberg, are just prescribing us very simple remedies that don't really stand up to scrutiny, like calorie labeling. We need to go back to basics. We need to exercise more. We need to eat less. We need to be more sensible about what we need. And ultimately, I think families need to spend more time at the dinner table eating together and less time at the drive-up window at the fast food joint. Unfortunately, it's difficult for Mayor Bloomberg to craft a policy that says as much. And, you know, the press conferences are much sexier when you talk about soda size.
And another topic that is sexy and where people are coming under attack is Big Pharma. There seems to be this view that just as McDonald's and Burger King and the others might be pushing burgers on us, Big Pharma is pushing drugs on us, more and more expensive drugs that don't necessarily do the job. Is that true or is that a myth?
I don't think that's entirely a myth. I think that you see with the pharmaceutical industry what you see with the hospital industry in other areas, that people are provided a variety of options, and yet they pay very little for what they get. So one big caveat here, I mean, it's incredible what prescription drugs have done over the last 60 years in terms of revolutionizing healthcare. I'm actually a psychiatrist, and you know, 60 years ago you had a depression, and we put you on the couch, and maybe you got better, and maybe you didn't. Today, the world of depression has been revolutionized by antidepressants, psychosis. I mean, people are simply locked up in asylums today. People on antipsychotics might even be able to return to the workforce. So it's extraordinary the changes that have occurred. But just because something's new doesn't mean it's better. And just because something's advertised on television doesn't necessarily mean it's something right for you and your family, right? And I think one sees with some of these drugs, which cost a lot of money, that because people pay a fraction of the cost of those drugs, probably 10 cents of every healthcare, every pharmaceutical dollar, they don't shop around and they don't ask the sort of questions that they might want to. Nexium's a great example of that. Look, John Elway's dreamy, and I thought he was great when he was a quarterback for the Denver Broncos, but just because he tells you that Nexium is better than the other purple pill doesn't necessarily mean it's worth spending seven times the money, or more correctly, your employer's money. So, I mean, these are some of the things you get in healthcare, because whether you're talking about pharmaceuticals or hospital care, you really don't have a market, you really don't have competition, and you really don't have health information easily accessible.
So really, it's fake competition. It's make-believe competition. I know you're a big believer in real competition, but when you see Big Pharma advertising on television a new product and saying, you know, you really must take this, and then they give you the caveats, be careful with this or with that, and they dribble them down. It takes about half the ad, and it's really scary. I mean, the whole thing just doesn't seem like a normal commercial pitch. Where do you stand on that?
Well, direct-to-consumer advertising with the pharmaceutical industry argues that they've got a First Amendment right to do that, so, and it's been upheld by the court. So that's going to continue. I don't think that's part of the problem, but I don't think it's part of the solution either. I mean, I think that's an example of what happens when people don't really pay for the health care they receive. Shiny and new is always better. Look, let's stop talking about drugs and let's talk about food, which is another basic need. If you walked into a supermarket and you knew that your employer would pay 87 cents of your grocery bill, would you ever wonder if you should get the flank steak or the really good T-bone? Okay.
I'd be on T-bone day in, day out.
Absolutely. Would you ever leave the grocery store with a shopping cart half full of food? You have the same sort of thing going on with healthcare, which is why we spend more and more money on it, and we don't necessarily get bigger and bigger results, right? So whether you're talking about pharmaceuticals or you're talking about 20 other things, I mean, it's the same basic economic problem, and it's that. Because when you're talking about healthcare in Canada, you're talking about healthcare in the United States, you've got really good doctors, you've got really good nurses, okay? What holds these systems back is the way we organize it, not the quality of the people involved in it, right?
But there's a specific fear here in this sector that you don't get in other areas where we have needs and wants, like feeding yourself. You feed yourself day to day, and you do your shopping every week or twice a week. You do all of that in increments, and it's within a reasonable budget, and then you have pricing and so on to help you make your decisions. But in the health, the real fear is against that huge illness or operation that somebody absolutely needs. And this used to happen in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
That somebody would have to have an operation, and it was the end of that family. It would just bankrupt them. They'd have to sell their house and so on. That's what people fear, and really we should be guarding against that.
Absolutely, but that's why we need health insurance, okay? Whether you live in Canada or the United States, what you don't want is, God forbid, a relative get ill, and then you have to sell the family home. But health insurance in Canada isn't about that. Health insurance in the United States isn't about that, right? Health insurance should function like every other insurance. In other words, it covers you for rare things that are catastrophic, right? I mean, home ownership insurance is not when your wife turns to you and says, I can't believe we painted the house brown. We ought to paint the house beige, okay? And you can't really tell the difference, but all you know is that the insurance is going to kick in and cover the cost of painting, okay? Car insurance, if you get into a terrible accident, you ought to be covered, right? But if you're, and maybe you've had this problem before, driving around and the little E comes on because there's this gas shortage within your car, the car insurance doesn't kick in, right? Because insurance should protect you against big events, not many small events. And we've confused that, both in Canada and the United States.
Well, Dr. Graetzer, I'll take your prescription, and I heartily recommend it to others. And I believe you have a book out, How Capitalism Can Save American Healthcare, and I recommend that as well. Thank you.
Splendid to have spoken with you.
Dr. David Graetzer. And now, here's something else coming up on The World Show.
We love doctors and we love nurses. And when we can say that sentence with the same kind of partnered equality, then I think we will save more lives. You know, there are studies that are showing that when you focus in on the partnership between doctors and nurses, you can actually reduce mortality rates by as much as 40%. And so what that needs for us to do is, as nurses, is to step up to the plate and be those equal partners to physicians. And we've had some experiments where that's happening, and patient care is improving quite a lot. We're making care safer in that context. So I would say that that's promising as a possible solution, and to give more voice to the nurse in that equal partnership with the physician.
The beauty of being a gold company, I have no accounting, no accounts receivable department. I have no marketing department. I have no bad debts. I have my bar. When we pour a gold bar, there are impurities because we just pour it. So we're not a smelter per se, but we do pour it, so it's molten. We have a silver content included in our bar, but our bar comes out gold.
What is it, 0.999 like they say on the
bars? Ours is not 0.99. Ours is anywhere from 85 to 88% pure, and then there's a silver content, about 8%, and then there's impurities. So what we do is that we have the luxury of that as a small company. We built our own lab. So we have a $1.5 million lab where we do atomic absorption, fire assay. So we can check when we're operating. So if we're going into a drift, we can take a face sample. We know it's 7-8 grams per ton. The geologist is happy, and they say keep producing that way. Keep following that. So we know what will be in the mill. So we're fully integrated.
A military contractor wanted to store their inactive records with us. And to do that, we had to be cleared for security. So our people had to be cleared and whatever. But they also had to clear the physical site where we would store these things. So the RCMP showed up one day and said, okay, we're here. Where's the room? You're going to store these things. And we said, we don't have a room. We have two buildings that are joined, two stories, six stories. They can go anywhere. And the RCMP said, we don't do buildings. We just do rooms. Oh, he said,
we don't do windows.
This is what we do. But let me explain it. And there's a parking lot. And the boxes come in. They're well identified. Today they're barcoded, not in those days. And we put them where there are spaces in the parking lot. We can't keep
irrespective of the logic of, which is better against theft in a way.
Well, this is the point. This is what we were explaining to them. We can't keep us. In fact, if you insisted on a room just for them, it would be much more expensive because they would have to charge as if it was full.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that. In addition, the boxes are all filed, by and large, three deep. So if you walk down these narrow aisles, you couldn't see two-thirds of the boxes. And they're anonymous. They're in our box usually, or some generic box that doesn't have the client's name on it, for sure.
So they secured the building, obviously.
They said, we give up. We secured the building.
Dr. David Graetzer was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.